Hello, podcast listeners, and hello, 1776 Club supporters. You know, we haven't done a pitch for a while.
We need to, because the 1776 Club has been wonderfully successful.
And for those of you who don't know, the Jefferson Hour is listener-supported. If you're interested in supporting the show, go to jeffersonhour.com and click on Support the Show. We can't tell you enough how much we appreciate your support for the show. We really, really do. So thank you. This week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, two interviews. The first with Stephen Lewis Simpson, an independent filmmaker whose latest film has just been released, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And then second, an extended conversation with the author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog, the book, Kent Nerburn, an old friend of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We're so glad to have him back. And you have to admire someone that's an independent filmmaker. I know what they're up against.
And you also really admire the work of Kent Nerburn.
I do.
Who's written a trilogy, but the first great book of it was called Neither Wolf Nor Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And now a film has come out.
And we talked with both gentlemen about that film in depth with Kent Nerburn, and he has some pretty interesting insights on our man Jefferson and how Western civilization views Native Americans. And you had some things to say about human nature, Clark.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that human nature is human nature, but we shape it differently according to culture. And we live in a culture, Western civilization is a culture that has been very happy to create social hierarchies.
Yes.
This show is about, it's about Native Americans who largely live at the edges of our society, often in great poverty. There are lots of interesting historical reasons why that should be the case, but for most non-Indians in the 21st century, at least most non-Indians in our state of North Dakota, the attitude is, why can't they get on board and share the American dream just as we do? Without ever thinking, well, maybe there are historical roots to this, A, and maybe they don't want to be quite identically like us either.
Which is really what Kent's book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, talks about and explains very, very well.
So let's go to the show, this program, which is Neither Wolf Nor Dog, Thomas Jefferson and Indians.
And thanks for listening. Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. Seated across from me today is the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, Clay.
It's great to be here, David, the semi-permanent guest host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, right here on the barn.
We had some marvelous conversations this week that we're going to share with our listeners, dealing with Jefferson and Native Americans.
Well, you've had a long-standing interest in the work of a man named Kent Nerburn, who grew up in Minnesota and is a novelist and an essayist, and he's written a trilogy about essentially how Native Americans see the world differently from the way non-Native Americans see the world. And the first of that series was a book called Neither Wolf Nor Dog on Forgotten Roads with an Indian Elder. That was back in 1984. After that came The Wolf at Twilight, and more recently The Girl Who Sang to the Buffalo. But the occasion of this conversation is that a film has been made of Neither Wolf Nor Dog.
And we must also mention his book about Chief Joseph, which he does discuss.
That book really influenced my thinking. So I've known you introduced me to Kent. I read Neither Wolf Nor Dog and loved it. And then I read Wolf at Twilight. And I read his book on Chief Joseph. Chief Joseph and the Flight of the Nez Perce, the untold story of an American tragedy back from 2005. And it is a really extraordinary book. And I'll tell you why. He says this in the interview that we have today, David. It's because he leads with his heart. His heart is in the book, mm-hmm. not just his head. And he freely admits that being a white person writing about Native American concerns is automatically problematic because of the possibility of misunderstanding or cultural appropriation or whatever. But his authenticity is such that he's been able to overcome it, as you have. You have been able to overcome that divide, the distrust, the problem of cultural appropriation.
I really have no self-awareness of that, but
you have in your long work with Native artists, musicians, drum groups. You've been to the Sundance. You've been to places that most white people never go because they choose not to go, and
or
places where white people don't go because they're not really wanted,
or they just don't know about it. But as you stated earlier, the real occasion for this is that his book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, has become a movie. So today on the program, we talked not only to Kent Nerburn, but also have a brief conversation with Stephen Lewis Simpson,
the filmmaker
who made the film. And it's fun to hear the two of them a bit back and forth on the process of having the movie made.
And not to reveal too much, but whenever a book of any sort becomes a film, there is a translation issue.
Of course.
My mother, whom I greatly love, goes to films and shakes her fist at the screen. That's not the book.
Yeah.
How dare you? She saw The Last of the Mohicans, and she is a great lover of Fenimore Cooper. And she shook her fist at the screen and took notes in a movie theater in her anger, in her wrath. And I kept saying, Mother, it's apples and oranges. It's apples and oranges. A film is not a book. A book is not a film. You can't hold the film responsible for the adaptation. It's an hour and 20 minutes.
Let's get to the interviews. But before we do, just briefly, for listeners who maybe are new or don't know, can you sort of give us an overview of what Jefferson's Indian policy was? Or is that impossible?
No, I can. It's really interesting because Jefferson looked west. Monticello was built with its portico looking west. And Jefferson saw the hopes and dreams of humankind in the west. He, in a sense, thought that the original 13 colonies were a little bit damaged because of their connection to Europe. But once we crossed the Appalachians, it was, in a sense, a new place, a new landscape for humans to create. But unfortunately, here's the problem, and I'll talk about it in today's essay. When Jefferson looked west, he saw it as empty, even though he knew better. So he really saw a blank landscape that he was going to inscribe with a utopia. He knew better. He knew that the West was peopled with native cultures, and he liked them and admired them and studied them and found them fascinating and even thought we had in some ways more to learn from them than they had to learn from us. But somewhere there's a kind of a broken connect, so that he couldn't see the West with them in it, really. And so this is the paradox of American history, of course.
Now, Kent speaks brilliantly about that.
It's amazing So this film is coming out. It's not a major motion picture, so you're going to have
it's people, an independent film.
People are going to have to sort of look for it.
But it'll show up.
It will show up, and of course it'll be on something like Netflix or Amazon Prime.
I believe we give Stephen's website. I think there's ways to rent it, or there will be.
Of course. So Jefferson's view was simple. Fascinated by native cultures, but he never actually saw a native culture intact. He always saw delegations or Indian cultures that had already had heavily been distorted by their mingling with non-Indian cultures. And then, given that, his fascination, he actually set in motion, as president, what I call the twin pillars of American Indian policy: voluntary removal, so that Indians would remove themselves from harm's way and go west somewhere into the vast, empty land of the West, as Jefferson imagined it, and that Indians would want to join us, that they would want to join the Enlightenment. They would want to have alphabets. They would want to use our inventions. They would want to live the way we do, to farm. They would want to join the American experiment, because it was, to Jefferson's mind, the most extraordinary achievement that humans had ever managed on Earth. Why wouldn't peoples who'd been separated and cut off from that want to join that club?
And we'll talk more about Jefferson's Indian policies during the course of the show, but right now, let's join our conversation with the director of Neither Wolf Nor Dog, Stephen Lewis Simpson.
Stephen, are you there?
Yes.
Well, welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Boy, thank you very much.
And we're talking to you from where, sir?
I'm in Los Angeles right now.
And you're a busy man promoting a film that you just released, Neither Wolf Nor Dog.
Yes, it's relentless.
You're an interesting fellow. At 18, you were the youngest fully qualified stockbroker and trader in Britain. But you ended up in South Dakota spending a great deal of time on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. How did that happen?
Well, the first time it happened was I'd been developing a screenplay relating to Wovoka, the five prophets who created the Ghost Dance religion that led to the killing of Sitting Bull and the Wounded Knee Massacre, ultimately through the series of consequences, and jumped on a plane and flew out there. And, within 3 hours, I'd been taken around Wounded Knee by a local. And then at the end of my first 3 hours, I find myself at Russell Means' house being asked to film 3 days of political meeting. You know, so I was just stuck straight on into the heart of what was going on, and it just built on that from ever since.
Stephen, this is Clay. You've done a couple of previous films Rezbaum, Ticking Man, Frog. What led you to Kent Nerburn's book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog?
It was Kent. He was in the area. I was showing on Pine Ridge. I'd been showing Rezbaum, the movie I'd made there. And in the local theater, in the screening we were doing, Kent approached me after with a copy of the novel and gave me a bit of the backstory regarding it having been pursued for the best part of 20 years by Hollywood. A lot of false promises being made. Nobody managed to push it across the line.
So for those who don't know the book or yet the film, give us a little summary of what your film attempts to get at.
The narrative follows the white author that, you know, Kent authored as himself, almost in the first person. And he gets a phone call out of the blue from the granddaughter of a Dakota elder. And the elder asks him to sort of distill his life's thoughts down into a book as a few false starts. And then the only real way it seemed to be able to accurately do it is to suck him into a road trip through the heart of their experience so that it becomes, you know, firsthand account of this man and his life and his views rather than, you know, the sort of traditional arm's length, you know, why is this thing kind of tale. You know, so most of it's what happens on the road and their experiences along the way.
What's the significance of the title, Neither Wolf Nor Dog?
Well, it relates back to a phrase from Sitting Bull, essentially, that, you know, agency Indians were neither Indian nor white, so they were neither wolf nor dog.
On the Jefferson Hour, we like to explore those complex issues, and the meeting of different cultures is certainly one of those, and I would assume that's part of the aim of the film. It's produced by Roaring Fire Films, which is a company that you formed in 1993.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, it would appear to be that Roaring Fire Films is kind of a one-man operation. You're responsible as a writer, director, cameraman, editor. What made you choose to do all of this yourself?
Well, I mean, to be honest, in the work I do in Indian country, I know that the industry is not jumping up and down to finance these films. And, you know, the key way of being able to shoot them for the budget that I can is by doing everything, and I've had enough experience to be able to pull that off, particularly on the technical side, because, you know, the creative side ends up being a tiny part of the process overall. And, you know, I had a crew of two, mostly during the shoot, and then it's been just me the rest of the time. And, you know, that's including booking it into theaters, doing a marketing campaign. And
we want to wish you all the success. My last question for you, sir, is what do you hope people will take away from this movie?
You know, for me, it's all about human beings. You know, I just basically want everyone to be looking at everyone else straight in the eyes. It's just one human being to another. And the key to that is empathy, not division.
So, Stephen, this is Clay. My last question. So you're right in the thick of all this, doing lots of interviews, traveling, helping to promote the film. What's next for you after this project?
I'm planning on being in Europe, in mostly Eastern Europe, filming a very dynamic, edgy, out there film. Stylistically, couldn't be more different to this. You need to push yourself into different corners as an artist, and I feel like I need to go to a completely different place, because it's been 18 years for me mostly doing Indian country projects, and so I need to be going as far from that as possible just as an artist to be challenging myself in a fresh direction.
Stephen Lewis Simpson, we wish you well with this project. Thanks for doing the work that you do. It's really important, and we appreciate your giving a little bit of your time to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
Before we say goodbye, we're talking with Stephen Lewis Simpson, an independent filmmaker whose latest effort, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, is in theaters now. Stephen, tell people where they can go if they want to find out the viewing schedule or get it online. Where should they go?
Well, thank you. There's Neither Wolf Nor Dog movie on Facebook. We have a page there where we can interact. Also, Neither Wolf Nor Dog Film.com, or go to tug.com for these individual screenings around the country, and people can even set their own ones up through it.
If they go to roaringfirefilms.com, they can see this huge body of work that you've done.
Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, sir, and good traveling to the Mideast.
Thank you very much indeed.
Once again, our thanks to Stephen Lewis Simpson. We need to take just a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week, a number of special guests.
We so appreciate Stephen Simpson giving us a little bit of his time. He's busy right now promoting and talking about this film, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which is just beginning to make its way through the theater system of the United States. But David, let's talk with Kent Nerburn. You have a long and interesting friendship with him.
Oh, he's a great guy, and we have Kent Nerburn on the line now. Hello, Kent.
Hello, David.
Kent, we're so glad you're with us today. We're so excited about the release of the film by Stephen Simpson, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And, of course, that film could not exist without your work in the book that you produced back in 1995. Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
And I'm excited to be here. I love your show and love Bismarck Mandan. That's old home territory.
So my question is, every writer dreams of having his or her book turned into a film.
Absolutely.
So you've got this extraordinary trilogy, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, followed by The Wolf at Twilight, and then most recently The Girl Who Sang to the Buffalo. And the first of that series, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, has been made into a motion picture. Talk about what happened here.
It was something that's been was a long time in coming. When I wrote the book, I had a feeling that there was the possibility of a film inside it. And I really never had thought about getting a film made, but I write very visually. I'm a slow reader. I write to be heard, and I was trained as a sculptor, so I tend to think visually. I tend to write at a pace that you can savor, and it transfers cinematically very well. A number of people wrote me and said immediately after the book came out, saying, this should be a movie, this should be a movie. Well, that's wonderful, and that'd be fine, but how is it going to happen? So into this comes a strange character named Stephen Lewis Simpson, who I'd run into out on Pine Ridge. I was out there doing something, I don't even remember what, but he was showing a film of his. He and I were staying in the same cheesy motel, and I gave him a copy of Neither Wolf Nor Dog, thinking, well, maybe this guy would be interested. Anyway, he and I just traveled together. We went to locations together. We talked about actors together. And we sort of came to this common understanding of what the film should be. I mean, being non-Native people, walking into any Native project, you know, you're walking a very, very fine line. And I didn't want someone who wanted to exploit the Native people. I wanted someone who understood something about being an ally. And Stephen seemed to understand that. And I think Stephen did a wonderful job, and I'm honored that he did it. And I think he's very happy with it, too. I know we both feel that it was a struggle, but it came out in the end.
Let's go to kind of 101 on this. What do you mean by the metaphor of neither wolf nor dog? What exactly are you trying to get at in that first of the trilogy?
I was very taken just by the phrase from Sitting Bull, that when he was speaking of the Native people who were hanging around the fort when the reservation system came in, he said, "We are neither we are neither wolf nor dog. We're neither the Indians in the wild nor civilized white men. We're neither wolf nor dog." So that phrase just stuck with me, and I applied it to the title of the book, not for any particular content so much as for just the notion that it was such a haunting phrase, and it spoke to me so much what it must have been like at that time and still to this day is the case for Native people, who try to hold on to traditions inside of a culture that doesn't respect those traditions and has done everything it can to try to, well, not try to, but sometimes consciously, sometimes accidentally, has decimated a lot of the Native culture and Native traditions. And so they remain neither wolf nor dog in our American culture. And that was just, it just struck me as a poignant metaphoric statement.
Yeah, we're talking on the Jefferson Hour today about Thomas Jefferson's role in all of this. And, you know, one of the historians who's worked extensively on Jefferson says, Jefferson is America. He embodies the paradoxes of America. He embodies both the hope, but also the dark side of the American experiment. And that certainly seems true to me, Kent, that Jefferson was fascinated by Native Americans. He sort of saw them as Republicans in buckskin, that they were better than we were in certain ways because they were more free. They represented human beings living in nature before culture had damaged them, sort of all that stuff out of Rousseau. And yet at the same time, Jefferson's view was, don't get in our way. We're going to move you. Well, I hope we can move you benevolently, but we're going to move you one way or the other because the American dream is not really about you.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Since the Europeans arrived on the American continent, we've had this incredible ambivalence towards the Native people. On one hand, they were the Rousseauian natural man that we wanted to be, you know, that we had gotten rid of the shackles of European civilization, and here were the pre-Adamic people of nature. And we admired that. We wanted that. We wanted to be those people. And at the same time, there was this whole Puritan streak of the Indian as the dark savage, and that these were the shining eyes in the forest at night. And we had this ambivalence toward them, and it's carried forward to today, where it's current iteration. It's the drunk and the layabout on one side, and then it's the Indian as the wise man on the other side. And Jefferson sort of walked the rationalist line down the middle, and I think he, to the extent that I understand Jefferson's thinking, was in love with that natural man. But America was the land of manifest destiny, and the Indians, for whatever else they were in the way. And so how do you address something that's in the way? You have to find some way to get them out of the way, and you either do it by eradicating them, assimilating them, relocating them, but somehow they have to be gotten out of the way of this incremental and inevitable force of civilization that he wanted to sweep across the country. And I think his fascination with the West, he set in motion something that was going to be an inevitable result, and that inevitable result is that the Native people were almost completely eradicated from the American consciousness as well as the American reality. And I think that in the case of film, in my works, I try to bring that element back into our cultural understanding. I think that we need to bring the Native experience back in as part of our cultural narrative, and I think we need to bring back in some of the truths that were eradicated along with the Native people when we tried to look at the blood on the land and where we passed. We like to keep it hidden from us. We're people of optimism. We just don't like to look at the blood on the ground where we've walked. And so to my mind, we need to bring the Native experience back into our cultural understanding, and we also need to look at some of the truths that the Native people had to offer. And that really was what Neither Wolf Nor Dog as a book was about, to show the Native point of view on what had happened to them, as well as to give some of the truths of their way of living. And the film, I think, does that very well. I think Stephen did an excellent job of factoring out the elements that were most important. The voice of the Native people is essential in that film.
I'm going to come back to the film here in a minute, but I want to just follow up. So Daniel Boorstin has a kind of a famous essay on Jefferson called Red, White, and Black, and he talks about how Jefferson saw the three races of America. So leaving white people out for the moment, Jefferson clearly saw us as the epitome of all the best that the world had ever seen so far. But he regarded African Americans as subordinate in such a way that he even posited that they might be a separate creation. And I mean, he didn't really make any attempt to disguise his racial contempt. But with Indians, Jefferson is fascinated like a Boy Scout. He wants to know about their artifacts and about their governments and about their the way they dress and about their hunting styles and about their cosmology. And he's a removalist, but he's utterly fascinated by Indian culture. That and Boorstin says that's a continuing paradox in American life. And yet this fascination with Native America, it began when the conquest was not even finished yet. You have Buffalo Bill starting Wild West shows to feature Native Americans when barely they've been herded onto reservations. You must think about this weird fascination / repulsion all the time.
Well, it's present everywhere. I mean, because I've gotten involved in trying to be an ally to the Native people, I've gotten to look at it up close. I've gotten to see it from the standpoint of what the white culture that I come out of, the Euro-American culture that I come out of, thinks of the Native people, and I've gotten to see it from the standpoint of the Native people themselves. Plus, I mean, we're talking about an area that that I know well and you know well, that this great midsection of America, that sort of forgotten land, where you can still feel the Native presence on it. I mean, when I go try to talk about my work in, like I was in New Hampshire not terribly long ago, and they don't have one square inch of land in New Hampshire that's still Native owned. And when you get out west, you feel the presence in the earth. You feel the presence of the Native people. You see how well they adapted themselves and their culture to the land that we all share. And when I think of Jefferson and his fascination with the West, you know, here I know it only in an ever so rudimentary fashion, but these were people of the land. I mean, when he sent Lewis and Clark out, he had them look at the land as artifact. He had them look. I think he was fascinated by the spiritual power of the land. I think he was fascinated by the unknown, the terra incognita nature of the land, and the Indians were part and parcel of this. The blacks were an imported presence, but the Indians were somehow indigenous here. And if you could bring back a chicken hawk, you could bring back rocks, you could bring back different species. Somewhere inside of that, the Native people were of common cloth, and that in some ways that objectifies them, in other ways that makes them part of this great unknown that he wanted to embrace. I mean, the shaping of America involved somehow coming to grips with the animals, plants, and natural forms on this continent. And at that time, I'm sure that it must have been something to be part of a nation that was that young and to know there was this vast unknown on the backside of your physical experience. And then when you get out there, everywhere you go, there's this other race of people with different languages, different ways of understanding, and beautifully integrated into the land. And how could you not be fascinated by them? And yet given a penchant for trying to objectify and quantify and understand things, how could you not do the same to them? So you end up with an ambivalence that's as deep-seated as anything you can possibly have. And we come forward to today, and what do we have? The same kind of ambivalence that the Native people, we objectify them in a different way. We mythologize them or pathologize them. And yet they are of the land, and I think that we've managed to kind of hide from the fact that they are the indigenous people, or they are indigenous to this land that we all share, and in that way have some fundamental relationship to it that is not ours. And I don't think we know quite what to do with that. And so we hide it, or we, like I said, we mythologize it, we pathologize it, we do something to get it away from the immediacy of our consciousness. And it does, the experience of the historical reality of slavery and the blacks is something that we can't hide from. It's there in its pigmentation. It's there in our whole historical development, our whole economic development. But we can hide from the native experience, and yet in many ways it's more fundamental than anything else.
So I have so many questions. We're not going to have time for all of them, but you've got to come back here and spend some time with us, because, first of all, I gave a talk recently on Chief Joseph, and I read your book, and I just loved it. It's just such an extraordinary book. I've read Elliot West's new book, and I greatly admire him, but I just love that book, and so I just am so grateful to the incredibly hard work you do to try to explain the kind of bloody tragic history of the American West to the rest of us. But I want to go back to Jefferson for just a minute, Kent. How do we avoid judging him? Because on the one hand, we get it that he sort of represents the paradox of American life. On the other hand, he set in motion, really more than even Andrew Jackson, the twin pillars of American Indian policy, which is a temporary removal followed by eventual assimilation. Was there another path, or what do we finally conclude about Jefferson's ambivalence?
Well, I'm of the unpopular school that we judge people by their times, not by our contemporary point of view on them. But that's always been my belief, that you see what the assumptions were with which people were working, and that you don't try to look from the point of view of what we understand today, because our point of view ultimately is as transient as theirs was. So to me, I mean, I've always looked upon Jefferson as one of my heroes, but it's almost but also mythologizing of Jefferson on my part, because I don't know enough about him. You know, it was Jefferson and Washington and Hamilton, and I have a cartoon knowledge of each of them. But his fascination with exploration of different modes of thinking, different modes of understanding. He was the best of the American explorer in the broad sense of the term. He explored ideas, he explored ways of living, he explored ways of thinking. He wanted knowledge of the sort that we have come to consider knowledge in the West. He didn't strike me as a man of deep, a mystical spirituality, and I may be wrong in that regard, but he was a man of intense curiosity, and that curiosity has really been it's been the source point and the driving force in the development of our American cultures. We're intensely curious about everything, and we're willing to open our minds and hearts to any other point of view, and I think Jefferson brought that into the fore. That was who he did. Somewhere in Jefferson, something happened where the European mindset turned and started looking to the West. And it may well have been that he was following in his own mind and heart the travels of the people that he sent out to explore the West. Somehow he started looking towards possibility in a different way. And to me, that makes him a real father of the country, almost the intellectual father of the country, more than Washington.
Well, that's a glorious answer and a very, very generous one. And I share your view that we are creatures of our times. But turning to Chief Joseph and the Nimiipuu, the Nez Perce, for a minute, that could have been avoided. I mean, in other words, it's not inevitable that every one of these terrible things that happened. That was a war that could easily have been avoided.
It seems like most wars could be avoided if we were willing to look straight on at what it is that we're trying in the wars. They're almost always economically driven. Joseph was willing to accommodate. He was willing to compromise. He was willing to accept the way of the European if they only would have let him keep his own ways as well. But the Christian tradition, the way that it's been brought into the American West, doesn't offer compromise. And Joseph really wanted to embrace his own way as well as the European way.
Gentlemen, we need to take a short break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kent Nerburn, the author of Neither Wolf Nor Dog.
Fascinating account of the sort of the ongoing paradox of American history with respect to white and Indian relations.
And to Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, he says a lot of interesting things about the third president, and in a way surprised both of us, I think, in how generous he was.
Agreed. I always enjoy Kent's perspective. As I said, we need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Hello, everyone. This is Clay, just jumping in to invite you to come on the annual Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour. It is the highlight of my travel year. 3 days on the wild and scenic Missouri River, 4 days up in the most pristine part of the Lewis and Clark Trail in Idaho. There are still a few places for this summer's trip, July 18th through 27th, out in Montana and Idaho. It's the trip of trips, bonfires. The stars are magnificent. We swim in the Missouri River. We talk about Lewis and Clark and Jefferson and life and you name it. That's the big signature trip, July 18th through 27th. And then in January at Locksaw Lodge, 1 4-day seminar on Walden and Edward Abbey, and another one on Shakespeare. And the Shakespeare seminar is almost full, so go to oddytours.net or jeffersonhour.com and get all the details. But join me for these special Jefferson Hour tours. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with or about President Thomas Jefferson. This week, our conversation is with a couple of gentlemen, the filmmaker Stephen Lewis Simpson and the author Kent Nerburn, and it's Kent Nerburn who is on the line right now. Welcome back, Kent.
Kent, we have a few more questions for you, sir.
But before we start, I must tell you, Kent, we have a rule at the studio we call the Nerburn Rule.
All right.
It's that we always have at least one, if not more, copies of Neither Wolf Nor Dog at the studio to give away.
That's a good rule.
And we do that because we look at the book Neither Wolf Nor Dog as a great primer for people to try to understand a different culture. And also to understand how broadening an experience it is to understand another culture.
I think that's really been what that book is about. And whether I look at it now for however many years and had the feedback, you start to know what you've done. And the thing that I think that book did is it allowed people to see through two sets of eyes. Very often you can see that there were just absolutely different paradigms at work, different paradigms of leadership. One of the distinctions that always comes to mind is the distinction between land and property. These different ways of understanding the earth and understanding the way we live on it really, I think, are well embodied in that book.
I can only imagine how difficult it was for you to go through the screenwriting process, a case of what you had to take out, I would assume. I was very pleased to see in the movie that you left the quote about white people and silence in the script.
Mm-hmm.
Could you share that with our listeners?
One of the real lessons that I learned being around Native people is that they understand silence, just like they understand empty space. Our culture is not comfortable with empty space. We see it as something dangerous and dark, but we're not comfortable with silence. They know that we will use language just to work out a problem. They'll throw something out, or they'll sit silently and say, let the white person talk. And eventually, they'll reveal their heart because they can't stand silent. They can't stand the empty space around their words. And so that was really one of the elements that I think needed to be gotten across in the film. And I think the film captures that sense of silence and space in a very good way.
When you were talking about the white man who shows up on the res, I was thinking about the line from Walden, Thoreau, where he says, if I knew for a certainty that a man was coming to my house with the conscious design of doing me good, I should run for my life.
No, I don't know that, but absolutely.
But you know, something you said really haunts me. You said that often non-natives come to Indian country seeking redemption, and I do believe that's exactly right. But don't you think it's weird that a people who crushed and colonized and peonized and despised Native people then come to them once crushed seeking redemption?
I don't think we know what to do with that aspect of our history. We don't do tragedy very well as a people, where there is no positive resolution. We always think we can talk our way out of it, work our way out of it, grow our way out of it. There's always
an optimistic endpoint. But sometimes there is no optimistic endpoint. Sometimes things were planted in the earth that have grown up in a way that cannot be harvested in a good and healthy sense. It's a good thing when we feel the need for some kind of redemption or confession. I mean, I think Dan's line was in The Wolf of Twilight. I think he said, "I don't care if you feel guilty. Guilty is just a way of feeling good about yourself. What I care is that you take responsibility." And that's really the way that I look at it. That if for us to say we're looking for redemption or somehow approval is no less real than for them to say, yes, we're angry and we want someone to say we're sorry. And if they can say that, and I can say, yes, my motives are not necessarily pure because I'm feeling somehow the weight of the cultural burden we placed on you, there's nothing wrong with that. We are who we are. You know, we came in the package we came in. The history we walked into is the history we were born into. And telling the truth may be the only way through in some cases. And so that, to me, I don't know that I want redemption. And that might be too strong a word, but I want recognition that I feel sad for what happened and wish that it had been done otherwise.
You said when a non-Indian walks into a Native American project, you're walking a very fine line. Can you unpack that a little?
Oh, absolutely. There is, number one, an initial presumption, or at least a fear on the part of the Native people, that it's another white man trafficking in Indian themes for fun and profit. And you have to disabuse them of that notion. Secondly, Wilma Mankiller once said, white people have such an astonishing sense of entitlement. They think that if their hearts are good, they have a right to ask anything, go anywhere, and do anything. And this is a trap that is so easy to fall into, to think that because our intentions are good, we will be accepted on the basis of those intentions, rather than recognizing that we can be transgressing. We can be transgressing values, we can be transgressing boundaries that are not ours to cross. Lastly, there's just this feeling that if we try to take the position of authority and position of ownership in any way, it's one more bit of cultural colonialism. So how do you go into the Native world in a way that's respectful and shows interest in who they are without appropriating, without creating any feel of discomfort on their part, without feeling that you're somehow using them? Because I think in some way we are using them, no matter who we are. Even if we're going in for pure friendship, there's something we want to get in terms of redemption, understanding, recognition, and it's hard to walk that line in a way that has a pure heart.
I'm looking at your bibliography. It's daunting, to say the least. Neither Wolf Nor Dog on Forgotten Roads with an Indian Elder, that was 1994. Chief Joseph and the Fight of the Nez Perce, The Untold Story of an American Tragedy, that's 2005. The Wolf of Twilight, 2009. Most recently, Voices in the Stones, November of 2016. Amazing. What are you working on now?
One of the things that I've gotten from working with Native people has been an appreciation of the role and status of an elder. And I remember being in a sweat lodge on my 60th birthday, and when it was time to give our petitions and our supplications, I said, I want to know how to be an elder. I want to know how to give back. And I reached what I think was the end of my overt work in writing about the Native people in Voices in the Stones, because that was the first time I turned and faced my audience and said, here, now I want to tell you what I have learned and what I know, as opposed to saying, come along with me and let us look together at this situation and have other people tell us what other people teach us. So that was kind of, though it's a small book, it was kind of my valedictory book in working with Native people. And so then I said, what is it that I as an elder can do at this point? And I looked around and I saw all the young people that I know in the arts and how they're struggling in the arts. And I wanted to write a book about the inner life of the artist and what it means to be an artist in this society. So it's a book, the book I'm working on, we only got a title for it. I'm working on it with Canon Yake, an English publisher that's a very fascinating publisher who had done such things as The Life of Pi, and they published their Barack Obama's works over there. Very high quality publisher about the inner life of the artist, teachings for young artists, because I think that the time of the arts, the importance of the arts is ever greater, and the constriction of the arts in contemporary society is getting greater and greater all the time. And I just want to give a feeling to the young people who are going into the arts, this is what you're facing, not just economically, but spiritually, culturally. What you're doing is important. It's important for you. It's a lonely task, an important task culturally, and I want to give you the benefit of my experience. I've been where you're going, and I want you to know what it's going to be like. So this book on the inner life of the artist is my my new passion, and I'm loving writing it. It's a turn, but I think it's a good turn.
I just have one more question for you, Kent. I hope you'll forgive me for asking it, but what's it like to see yourself portrayed in a movie?
I went out to the set where it was being filmed, and I got to know Chris, who played me in the film. And Chris is a very dynamic human being. I mean, he's a Silver Star winner from the first Iraq War. I mean, he and I once had a conversation. I said, well, you know, if there's a fight in a bar, I just shut up. He says, I'll go across the table at them. And I said, well, I go to the table and take notes. But I thought it was just a wonderful portrayal. And like I said, it's only just a matter of the embarrassment of now when I walk on stage and say, well, I'm going to talk about that movie. They say, who's this old guy here? We thought he looked like this handsome young man on the screen. So, but it's fun. It's fun to see someone take on your character. It's fun to see someone interpret your own words. And I thought it was just wonderfully done.
That's great. Kent Nerburn, Under the Table, Taking Notes. We've been speaking with the author Kent Nerburn about his book Neither Wolf Nor Dog, which is now an independent movie. And I'm suspecting, Kent, that if people want to find out more, they can go to your website.
The website is Kent Nerburn, KentNerburn.com. So I do more on Facebook than I do on my website, but I certainly have the information both places. Check out the blog, check out the Facebook pages, because there's usually something going on them.
Once again, the website, KentNerburn.com, KentNerburn.com, or find him on Facebook. And one last time, Kent, I want to thank you for giving us so much of your time this week. We always enjoy talking to you.
Great. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Godspeed.
And also, our thanks to the independent filmmaker, Stephen Lewis Simpson. And now, it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
The most amazing thing about Thomas Jefferson is that he embodies both the soaring aspirations of the American dream and the incomprehensible paradoxes of our national identity. Nobody ever pitched our national experiment so high, not Abraham Lincoln, not Theodore Roosevelt, not John F. Kennedy. Jefferson envisioned the freest, most virtuous, most peaceful, most self-actualized, most self-governing, and happiest people who ever walked the face of the earth. We hold these truths to be self-evident, he said, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unless you're black. Unless you're a woman. Unless you're an American Indian. Then it's not so self-evident after all. Jefferson was fascinated by American Indians. They represented to him a time warp portrait of what we once were. Just as John Locke said, in the beginning all the world was America, so too in the beginning all people were like Indians, dressed in the skins of animals, living lightly on the land, nomadic, so loosely governed as to appear to live in a kind of idealized anarchy. These republicans in buckskin lived in harmony with nature and nature's God, had mutually beneficial relationships with other creatures, and practiced freedom in its most radical sense. If they had social compacts, they were the lightest possible glue that can minimally hold those tribal societies together. In Jefferson's view, we had a great deal to learn from these dwellers of the woods, what the French called sauvages, and we darkened to savages. They were us before absolutist governments, before state religions, church hierarchies, debtors' prisons, and opera. But here's the paradox. When Jefferson looked west from his Palladian portico at Monticello toward the vast interior of America, he could not help but see an empty continent, a tabula rasa, a blank slate on which we had it in our power to inscribe the most interesting civilization that the world had ever seen. Sometimes in his exquisite letters, Jefferson spoke of an American canvas that we in our enlightened wisdom would slowly fill up. In his first inaugural address, Jefferson spoke of a chosen country with room enough for our descendants to the 100th and the 1,000th generation. Jefferson knew better. He knew the continent was not empty, but full. He was fascinated by Native Americans. He collected Indian artifacts and proudly displayed them in his lobby museum at Monticello. He loved to meet Indian delegations at the White House, where he gave carefully crafted speeches in basic English, filled with what one critic has called Indian baby talk. So Jefferson knew the continent was full, but his dream of a highly educated agrarian American republic was so compelling and beautiful that it caused him sometimes to forget that the Cherokee, Choctaw, Seminole, Iroquois, and many others literally stood in the way. When he did remember to think about the Indians who had been living on his tabula rasa for many centuries, even millennia, he let himself imagine that by some non-confrontational magic process, they would glide out of the way. In some deep recess of his consciousness, Jefferson nourished a streak of ruthlessness that was determined to take the continent for ourselves, no matter what it might require, a determination not to let a bunch of Stone Age nomads get in the way of humankind's greatest moment. On the few occasions when Indians resisted his gauzy vision with shows of violence, when his patience and benevolence were pushed to the brink, Jefferson spoke of driving them beyond the Mississippi River, or even beyond the Rocky Mountains, and on more than one occasion the words "even to extermination" slipped past his enlightenment. He was no Andrew Jackson, but Andrew Jackson's vicious and unapologetic Indian policies were not that different in substance from Jefferson's more careful and subtle attempts to formulate a national response to what forever since has been called the Indian problem. What was that problem? From Roanoke Island to the Dakota Access Pipeline Project, we regard the continent as our own playground, homeland, resource base, and home, and Indians keep getting in the way. The essential paradox of American history is that the Europeans who bumped into the Western Hemisphere in the late 15th century immediately and ever since have regarded Native Americans as a nuisance rather than a legitimate sovereign. The great Ogallala leader Red Cloud said it best, "They made us many promises more than I can ever remember, but they kept only one. They promised to take our land, and they did." Here we are, late in the second decade of the 21st century, and we still don't quite know what to do about Indians. We call them Native Americans now, or First Americans, or, better, the Shoshone, Lakota, or Nimiipuu. Indian rights are better respected today than ever before in American history. The conquest phase of American history is now over, at least the musket and Gatling gun phase of the conquest. But white people are not yet ready to treat Native American nations as true sovereigns. They are not ready to apologize, and when push comes to shove, they are not even yet ready to share. Looking for the historic roots of all of this? It would make sense to start in the Dome Room at Monticello, gazing west. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.